The great Gothic cathedrals of Europe were among the most astonishing achievements of Western culture. Evoking feelings of awe and humility, they make us want to understand what inspired the people who had the audacity to build them. In his new book, The Gothic Enterprise, A Guide to Understanding the Medieval Cathedral, Robert A. Scott explores why medieval people built Gothic cathedrals, how they were built, what conception of the divine lay behind their creation, and how religious and secular leaders used cathedrals for social and political purposes. As a traveler's companion or a rich source of knowledge for the armchair enthusiast, The Gothic Enterprise helps us understand how ordinary people managed such tremendous feats of physical and creative energy at a time when technology was rudimentary, famine and disease were rampant, the climate was often harsh, and communal life was unstable and incessantly violent. Robert A. Scott is Associate Director Emeritus of the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University. He is the co-author of Why Sociology Does Not Apply, the author of Making of Blind Men, the editor of several collections of essays about stigma, deviancy, and social control, and the author of numerous articles, book chapters, and essays on related topics. He's also our guest here today on Nonfiction and here at WBAI. Bob, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
And thank you for this book. And I should say that you're my favorite kind of scholar, and that is to say someone who has developed a career and a life in a particular field and then, using the resources that you've acquired in that area, attack something completely unrelated to what you're doing in order to pursue a question in your own mind. The work you did with this book, investigating the reason or the foundation or the basis of the cathedral, was something that came out of your own passion these structures.
That's right. My wife and I visit Gothic cathedrals whenever we have an opportunity to do that, and we travel quite a bit in England and in northern France and elsewhere on the continent. Whenever we enter a cathedral, sooner or later, the question arises in my mind of how it would have been possible to do this in the context of medieval society. And this question, it turns out, is one which I've discovered so many people ask themselves and never really quite understand the answer to it, of how they simply walk away in disbelief. And it was really the fascination with that particular question as the starting point that got me to begin to investigate this topic. The topic is one which is just a marvelously interesting one and very, very complicated, and it's like a candy store for a scholar to be able to get in there and begin to piece together the story.
What is this book about?
Well, it actually began as a story of one cathedral, that is Salisbury Cathedral, which is the initial one that I became so interested in.
And where is that located?
That's located in the county of Wiltshire in England. It's about 20 miles north of the port city of Southampton, or about 100 miles west of London, very near where Stonehenge is located. So I became very interested in Salisbury, and I began to read about it, and I didn't start this project as a sociological project. It was just idle reading because I got so interested in this one building. But as I began to read it, I realized it was one of the most interesting sociological puzzles that I had ever encountered in all of my years of teaching and writing. And it became, as I investigated it, more and more curious to me as to how this enterprise of cathedral building, which was taking place in Salisbury, but then all over Europe, all at the same time, how did it get started and why did it get started and how was it possible to have achieved it? The more I investigated conditions of living during that particular period in history and the obstacles that people faced, the more persuaded I became that it couldn't possibly have been done, and I felt at one point as if I could actually prove it didn't happen. It was so improbable to me.
You're saying that when one looks at a cathedral and looks at how they're made and what they're made of and how they were designed, and then you say, okay, now look at what was going on.
That's right.
In this part of the world at that time.
That's right.
It's almost akin to what, finding an automobile in a cave and saying Neanderthals came
yes,
up with this?
That's a very good analogy, yeah. Mm. I mean, it just boggles the mind to imagine.
It's out of whack, so to speak.
It is. It's completely out of whack. And so that really is the kind of sociological puzzle that got me going here and took me away from just focusing on a single cathedral to beginning to think about cathedral building generally as it was taking place all over Europe.
Now, explain why it's out of whack. Explain what it was that was going on at the time.
Sure, sure.
And why these structures don't seem to don't seem to juxtapose well with the...
Okay. Well, I can describe it kind of graphically in this way. If you take the case of England, at the period of time when the most active period of cathedral building was going on, where there were something in the order of 26 such cathedrals in various stages of construction.
And what time was this in
this history? Would have been in the beginning around the late 12th century into the 13th century and then extending into the 14th. These things took a long time
so
to build.
So this is the 1100s, the 1200s,
yes,
and the 1300s.
That's correct, mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, at that time, the population of England, there's some dispute about this, but I don't think anybody would claim that it exceeded 6 million. Some people say it was 4.5, but that's basically the range of the size of the population. That means that it's basically a nation with a population that is the size of our state of Georgia. Its landmass is equal to the landmass of our state of Alabama. One third of the total population consists of young people, the majority of whom are 5 years of age or younger. So you have a very young population. And another 7% are people who are at an age in the life cycle where they are consuming more goods than they're able to produce. Life expectancy is very short. If you live to the age of 20, and mind you, only 4 out of 10 live births resulted, people actually survived to the age of 20.
Hence the small number of young people.
That's right. Then what you would do is you would have another 2.5 to 3 decades of life. It was a period of time when the plague was sweeping Europe and decimating the population. It was a period in the later part of this cathedral building when the worst famine to afflict the Middle Ages in that whole period, a 7-year period of famine, which was brought about by incessant rain during the spring and summer and fall and freezing cold during the winter. So all those things were going on, as well as wars and civic unrest. And when you look at all of that and you say, and yet in the midst of all of this, here are 27 of these monumental structures being built, Salisbury, Winchester, Wells, Canterbury, Gloucester, and so on. It just strains the imagination to understand how a society where life was, as Hobbes puts it, so nasty, brutish, and short, could possibly have produced this. Another point I would make is that, to put it in perspective, because these construction projects took so long, in England, I think the average I worked out was something like 235 years. Now that means that if,
to build one of these.
That's from the time that they began the work until the time in which the last major building campaign ended. Now, if you put that in perspective, it means that if in America we had begun to build a cathedral when our own nation was founded in 1776, it still wouldn't be finished. And it wouldn't be completed until the year 2033. So when you look at that, it's a staggering accomplishment and a great mystery, a great puzzle to understand how it could have occurred.
What is a Gothic cathedral? Or even more, what is a cathedral?
Yeah.
And then what makes a cathedral Gothic?
Okay. Well, let's start with what is a cathedral. And I'll answer that narrowly, and then I'll begin to talk like a sociologist to give you my take about what I think it is about. The cathedral technically is the seat of a bishop. The church is organized into a series of territories called bishoprics, and each bishop is head of one of these bishoprics or dioceses. The cathedral is, in effect, the church that where the seat of the bishop resides. It is basically the place where the bishop is worshiping that on behalf of the community.
Okay, got it.
So technically, that's what it represents. But I think I would want to answer that question more broadly in the following way. If you think about the kind of social institutions and social services that are available to us in the modern age when confronted with emergencies, what you realize is that we are kind of embedded in a kind of infrastructure of institutions that are very, very efficacious. If a fire breaks out, fire departments can come and put it out. If there's a medical emergency, it can be taken care of, and you can be taken to an emergency room where people can intervene and actually help you. So we have systems of justice, we have public health services, we have water departments, we have municipal services, and so on. Now, what you have to understand is in the medieval period, social institutions were basically ineffectual in their ability to be able to intervene in any way that could be helpful at all.
So what you're saying is that during this time period, we're talking about the 1100s, 1200s, mm-hmm. 1300s, mm-hmm. that essentially you're on your own, so to speak, in terms of being part of a community or society?
Yeah. I'm not saying that it's individuals who are on their own, but rather communities who are not able to be protected by the institutions we have grown accustomed to having surrounding us.
Were there fire departments back then?
No. And as a matter of fact, I mean, fire is a very good example because if a fire broke out, there was no mechanism for projecting a stream of water to a second floor. And the only thing to carry water in would have been leather buckets, and so you would have to go to either a river or a pond or a well and get it and bring it back and throw it on. Well, by the time you did that, the fire would be out of control. So basically, the only defense against fire was to stand back and let it burn itself out. Now, what I'm saying is that life at that time is equivalent to living in a society that lacks the capacity for a 911 number. That's the shorthand way to think about it. The belief was that the only reliable source of protection that would have been available was the intervention of God. And what the cathedral represented was the kind of place where the community sought to invoke the protection of the divine against all of the awful things that were happening or could potentially happen. So what the bishop really represented was, in effect, the figurehead for an entire community, for an entire region, where by properly venerating God through this kind of body of canons who would have occupied the cathedral, what he was basically doing was making sure that God remained on friendly terms with this particular community so that the community could invoke God's protection if need arose to do that.
Wow.
Now, one other point that I would make is that what people don't often realize is that cathedrals, it wasn't that ordinary lay people couldn't go into them. They certainly could. But the purpose of the cathedral was not to provide a place of worship for ordinary citizens. It was to provide a space where the bishop and the body of canons over which he presided could engage in a continuous round of liturgy, that is, of worship services, which took place from the middle of the night right through to the end of the day and back into the middle of the night. It was a continual round of prayers which involved processions. That's why these spaces are so elaborately laid out, because there were all of these processions that would accompany the various kind of rituals. And the whole purpose of this basically was to make sure that God would retain a friendly disposition to the community, because without that, the community was literally without any means of protection.
What I'm getting from what you're saying, Bob, is that a cathedral is almost like the inverse. It is the architectural inverse of calamity.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly what it is. That's very well put.
It's as grand and luxurious as the people's lives were bitter and hard.
That's right.
And it served almost as like a telescoping point.
Mm-hmm.
Mission control, sort of? Like a place where you have this specialist whose job it is to maintain this dimensional connection with God.
That's
why it was there in the place of all this other stuff, because in a certain sense, nothing else except bad stuff.
Bad stuff
going
is
on
happening.
Around
That's
it.
Right.
So this is the one place where it's almost like the beacon goes up.
And just if I can pick up on that point, because it's a very important point you're making, what makes the cathedral as a kind of type of space markedly different from everything else in the secular world is the degree of orderliness that you find in it. Now, I didn't know about this.
And this also makes it really hard for someone studying this area to figure out why was it so organized at first. So when you're studying it, why was it so organized when everything else was so...
That's right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So what you discover when you start looking into it is that what I've called the liturgy is basically two sets of volumes. One is called the ordinal, the other is called the customary. And these things tell you, if you're a member, if you're a canon in the cathedral, it schedules your life for one entire year, literally down to the minute. It's almost like a military field manual. It's so precise, and it tells you what you're going to be doing at a particular time of the day, what kind of prayer service you will be involved in, what the content of that will be, what the demeanor should be, what your dress should be. Who will be leading it, who will be responding, and it goes on and on and on. And when you read this, you realize that what they have laid out is a system of absolute order for one entire year. And it stands in marked contrast to everything else that was happening in that world. So your point is really very, very well taken.
We're speaking with Robert A. Scott. He's Associate Director Emeritus of the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University. His new book is titled The Gothic Enterprise, A Guide to Understanding the Medieval Cathedral. What makes a cathedral Gothic?
What makes a cathedral Gothic is the architectural style. Now, most people, when they think about Gothic cathedrals, will think about flying buttresses and arches and stained glass windows and so on. And all those things do, in fact, define the Gothic style. But the key to understanding it is, why are those features necessary? And to understand that, you have to understand what the builders were attempting to accomplish.
And flying buttresses are structures on the outside?
On the outside that are propping up the walls.
Right.
That make it possible for the walls to be built very high, to make it possible to put windows in it to get light inside.
Okay.
Now, if you start looking into this, you end up asking the question, why do you need these features? And the answer to that, I think, is the following, that the builders of Gothic cathedrals were basically trying to give those who entered them, this would be the way they would describe it, they wanted to give them a foretaste of heaven. They wanted them to know what heaven would be like if they got there after their own demise.
Wow.
And so then the question is, well, if you're going to do that, then what do you think heaven is like? And the answer they came up with is basically that heaven is very orderly, and the key to a Gothic cathedral is its geometric regularity. what makes it different from previous styles of cathedrals that were built, these were called the Romanesque cathedrals, is that there is this kind of slavish devotion to geometry. If I could take one example, Salisbury Cathedral, if you go to that cathedral and enter it, at the point of the central crossing, where basically it's the main point where the east-west axis intersects with the north-south, there's a space there that is exactly 39 feet by 39 feet. There's nothing magical about 39 by 39. It's just that it's geometrically square. You can work it out for literally every dimension of that building. Every dimension of it is a derivative of that. The height, the length, when they put the tower and spire on, you can work it all out that it's exactly derived from that. And the idea
is... Do you mean it's a multiple of 39 in some way?
It's a geometric derivative of it. Every bay, every element within a bay, and so on. Now, the idea there is basically that what you are doing is that the quality that defines heaven is this kind of geometric regularity and stability. And if you are going to give people a foretaste of heaven, then you have to have a structure, a building, that has this same geometric regularity to it. At the same time, heaven is light, and that's why light is so important. And the building has to be built in such a way that there is no part of the interior that is not touched by light. So you can't have dark corners. Well, when you then try to create a structure that expresses these ideas, then it turns out you need arches, you need windows, you need flying buttresses, and all these elements we call defining features of Gothic architecture are basically required by this intention of, in effect, building a space that resembles what medieval theologians thought heaven looked like. That's basically the idea.
So this was a cooperation between architects and ministers and such?
Well, architects per se didn't exist. Basically, it was conversations taking place between bishops who were representing the theology and talking to people who were called master builders. And master builders basically were ones who were skilled in the craft of building grand structures and working together, evolving and solving the technological problems that you needed to solve in order to be able to get this thing constructed.
Amazing.
Yes, it is.
Utterly amazing. And amazing that these structures took so long to build and could emerge from a 2 1/3 century building process and yet be a coherent thing.
Yes.
A thing that wasn't, you know, made up of the composite sort of extrapolations made in, you know, someone's fancy, you know, one century, and they say, hey, we want to go this way with it now.
That's right.
It's we have coherent.
That's right. That gets back to the geometry. Because when Salisbury Cathedral was built, now, Salisbury was put up in what was then regarded as lightning speed because they estimate it took about a century, and that was just record time for building a cathedral in those days. But still, a century means three generations have come and gone, between three and four, I suppose. So the question is, how could you retain coherence in design over that period of time? Now, to give you a contrast, Canterbury Cathedral, which is one of the grandest cathedrals in all of England, it's just a magnificent place, that took, I think it was, well, it was over 300 years to build. Now, when you think about that, it's not as if work crews showed up every day for 345 years, day in and day out, you know, and built away. It wasn't that at all. It was rather that so long as they had the funds, they would be able to work at a particular renovation or building of one segment of it. That would finish, and then you could have periods for as long as 50 or 75 years when nothing happened. And then they would come back and they would begin to pick up the next thing. Well, you don't have architectural drawings. There isn't paper. You can't record this very easily on parchment because parchment, it turns out, won't really last very long. So the question is, how would they know when they come along 75 years after the last piece of it was built, what to do? Well, I think the answer has to do with this geometry, that basically the geometry is acting like a genetic code for the building. And so what you could figure out is what the dimensions of whatever it is you wanted to build next would have to be in order for it to conform to the basic defining geometry of the building.
Mm.
Now, I don't want to leave the impression that every cathedral is as coherent as I'm describing. Salisbury is. Others deviate from this somewhat, but still, they are really achieving a remarkable coherence in their design, even while under construction over 2 and 3 and 4 centuries.
It's amazing that these things, which took so long to make, still stand as well.
That's right.
And they were made a very long time ago, before we even had the terms of architects,
yep,
or engineers.
Yeah.
But yet these are still very robust structures, many of them being used continuously today,
yep,
centuries later.
Yeah.
What did they understand? I mean, it almost seems like cathedrals are kind of like the ultimate expression of they sure don't make them like they used,
yes,
to.
Yes, yes, that's right. Well, these were built to last. Now, I need to explain the mindset of the medieval theologian. There's a fascinating book that I read about the year 1000. And what was so interesting about that is that theologians prior to the year 1000 assumed that the year 1000 would be Judgment Day. None of them ever imagined that the world would be around after the year 1000. Well, when it survived, then their time horizons expanded, but they never expanded vastly. The builders of cathedrals were basically trying to build structures which they believed would last until Judgment Day arrived. Without being able to specify when it was, they knew that it had to be made out of very endurable material, and what they were trying to do there was basically to take the version of the Christian story that they thought was the correct orthodox one and encode it in materials that would last forever. So this is why statuary is carved out of stone, and it's saying these are the saints who are legitimate figures in the Christian community, and we will embody them in such a way that they will not decay. So you don't make statues out of wood principally, you make them out of stone. So the idea was basically that what you're doing is taking a single version of the Christian story, materializing it, but using materials that you believe are in effect going to last for as long as they need to last, as long as the world will last.
These, in fact, materials embody the very idea of eternity.
That's exactly right. It's so interesting that they're made out of stone, because if you think about all the building materials that are available that could have been used, there's only one you cannot actually see forming. It's stone. Wood you can see forming because you can watch trees grow. But what you want to do is put it in stone, because that gives this kind of eternal, timeless quality to it.
And then because you don't see it forming as well, there is also the fact of whatever made this did so with a hand that I cannot observe, through a process I cannot understand.
Yes.
It pre-exists.
Yes,
me,
that's exactly right.
Me.
Exactly right. Yeah. Exactly right. Yeah.
So in so many ways, the cathedral was the manifestation of ideas about God and spirituality in three-dimensional form.
That's right.
And all of its details can be looked at as either ways of expressing those ideas or ways of supporting the expression,
that's right,
of those,
that's
ideas.
Right. That's exactly right. And if you visit cathedrals, you realize how brilliant the designers and builders were, because my wife and I have led tours of cathedrals around England just so I can show people what my passions are about and kind of introduce them to this topic. And it's not uncommon for people who will come on these tours, many of whom are not practicing Christians, but they will come on these tours and walk into the cathedrals and say, this is amazing. I'm not a practicing Christian, but it makes you feel religious. It's brilliant architecture. It actually works. It actually works. It gets all the elements together in a way that evokes precisely what it was designed to evoke.
Why did people stop building cathedrals?
Well, there are a lot of answers I would give to that. One of them that is something we haven't touched on yet, but it's very important to understand, is how much it costs to build one of these things, because these were incredibly expensive at a time when there was very little liquid capital. Just as a quick example, the building of Westminster Abbey in the city of London, which was taking place at exactly the same time that Salisbury Cathedral was under construction, there was a 25-year period where the entire cost of that was being underwritten by the king, Henry III. He was the sole patron. And historians have gone back and calculated that basically he spent, in the renovation of that one building, 5% of all the revenues that were available to him and at his disposal to run the entire kingdom. I mean, there's nothing like it in the modern world, nothing even remotely like it that would consume that kind of capital. So it's a way of just saying how very, very important the cathedral was. But it also tells you why it basically had to stop, because if you have cathedrals being built all over England or all over northern France, and you're a bishop and you want to build your own, you can't just build something that's average relative to all the others. You've got to do something that will make a statement about your place in the Christian community.
A cathedral arms race ensues.
That's precisely what it is. It's precisely what it is. So what happens is that because of that, the cost keeps going up and up and up. So I think that part of what caused this all to come to an end is basically that it got the value of building a cathedral that was a few feet higher than the largest one already built was so exorbitant that at a certain point it became impossible to raise the funds to do it. That was one thing that did it. But then the Reformation, of course, came along, and there was this whole kind of reaction against this kind of building of these buildings that were just infused with gold and silver and precious stones of various kinds and stained glass and so on. And the feeling was, let's get back to more basic elements in the practice of Christianity. And so I think those are the kinds of things that were coming together.
And then with the Reformation as well, you had a reformation of thought.
That's right.
In Europe, about the role of man in the universe,
yeah, uh-huh.
His relationship to God, etc.,
right.
That
yeah.
completely demystified
That's
the kinds
right.
of thinking that would
That's
have led
right.
to a cathedral,
sure.
it
That's
seems.
That's right. And I think another thing I would point to is the plague. The plague had an amazing impact in two respects. One is that in urban areas of Europe where the plague hit, the current estimates are that 60% of the urban population died. It was just staggering. Well, you need a lot of workmen to build a cathedral. And so that meant that the style had to change to one which was much more assembly. It's called perpendicular. It's much more assembly line-like in its design, much less individualized. That was one thing. But of equal importance is that what bishops were basically claiming is that they were, well, the term I would use are spiritual brokers. Basically, what they were saying is that ordinary people like you and I need mediators between ourselves and God, and we should not try to deal with God one-on-one. What we ought to be doing is going through these spiritual mediators. Well, as long as those spiritual mediators were able to prove their efficacy, we could be persuaded of this. And they would do that basically. That's why miracles were so important, showing, right, the presence of God, that I can access this power on behalf of the community and so on. The reason the plague is so important is because it was the priests who were dying in equal numbers to everybody else. And ordinary people are saying, wait a minute, if you're so privileged in your relationship to God, how come you're as victimized by this disease as I am? So it undercut the legitimacy. And then you can see how that would then begin to lay the foundations for the kind of Reformation theology that occurred.
Wow.
Yeah.
Utterly fascinating. And so in the building of these structures, and then in the process by which they ceased to be built, one has the tableau of European religious belief, philosophical belief, science, medical etiology, the whole bit. It's
everything.
All, the story is wrapped up.
It's all wrapped up in there.
In these structures.
That's right.
The time for cathedrals then has passed. We could build them today, but are you saying it wouldn't make sense to? That it would only be a gesture of nostalgia?
I think that might be right. You could build a comparable structure.
We're trying to build one here in New York.
Yeah.
We've been trying to do so for, I think, over 100
that's
years.
Right.
The Cathedral of St. John the Divine.
Sure. But the role it will eventually play in the community, it will play an important role, but the role that it will play is not the one that the medieval cathedral of Europe played in the communities of Europe. And the cathedrals today are very, you know, vital and very active, but the role that they're playing in the community is not the same role that they played in the medieval period. It's a very different kind of enterprise, equally noble, but it's a different kind of enterprise.
I remember reading in Amiri Baraka's book, Blues People, him saying that, I think it was a Babylonian, he said, would not have been able to comprehend the Empire State Building as anything other than a temple to God.
A temple, yes, yes.
And I then also remember someone saying that upon showing an African woman of I'm not sure what nation a building like that, a skyscraper, her responding, oh, these people must have a lot of family members. Because in her conception, a building that big would have to be an extension of family.
Yeah.
That was her relationship to architecture. It's utterly fascinating how in each time we build structures that invisibly for those times perhaps talk about how we see the world. I'm wondering what, based on your studies, the people of medieval Europe would make of New York City. If they were to come here and look at this and
look
see
at
these structures,
yeah.
what would they make of it? Besides, I mean, I'm sure they'd be awed, you know, at the height of these structures. But would they see this as a religious city, a religious enterprise
because
of all these tall structures?
They would, I think, understand large audacious structures as religious monuments and be puzzled by how religious we must be is what I'm just sort of hazarding a guess here. They would look at them and they would certainly not see them as they might see castles. These do not look like fortresses that are designed for defense purposes. So that I would imagine people would look at them and say the only motive I can imagine here would be religious, but why would there be so many churches? You know, because if you look at the skyline of Manhattan, it would seem like everybody had their own private chapel. It's just the size of the Chrysler Building.
We've been speaking with Robert A. Scott. He is Associate Director Emeritus of the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University. He's written a wonderful book called The Gothic Enterprise, A Guide to Understanding the Medieval Cathedral, and as well as looking thoroughly and thoughtfully at a subject that a lot of people probably don't give a lot of thought. He's also written a very readable book, I should say, and I always try and commend the scholars who appear on nonfiction who've written books that are scholarly but not dense. It's a very clear text, and it talks about not just building but about theology, about history. It's really a good way to look at the way the built environment shapes a society and is shaped by a society in really any time. And it's very, very highly recommended. And it's on University of California Press. Robert Scott, thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed the conversation greatly.